Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today's guest is Professor Michael Roda, an associate professor of philosophy at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. This marks 2 weeks in a row we've had a philosopher on the program, which may cause me to lose consciousness at some point. Just poke me and wake me if that happens. Dr. Roda earned his PhD at St. Louis University and served time at Harvard as a postdoctoral fellow in the 2006 and 07 academic year. Mike specializes in the philosophy of religion, medieval philosophy, with an emphasis on St. Thomas Aquinas, which is probably good given that he is at the University of St. Thomas. And he also throws into his academic mix some insights into contemporary metaphysics for good measure. He has published in a number of philosophy journals and is the author of the just-released book, Taking Pascal's Wager, Faith, Evidence, and the Abundant Life, out with InterVarsity Press this month. We will link to that book, a highly readable yet intellectually challenging text, over at our website, and we will also link to Professor Roda's own personal website, filled with many marvelous metaphysical insights as well as alliteration. So please check that out, and don't forget that we are on Facebook and Twitter, so check us out there. Mike, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Professor Gill.
As I'm reading through your bio here, I notice that there's a lot of saints. You're at St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, and got your PhD at St. Louis University, and then spent time at St. Harvard. Many people would give sainthood to Harvard. You must be Catholic.
I am, yeah. I was raised Catholic, but in sort of nominally. So we prayed before meals, went to Mass most of the time, but that was about it. And then later in college, I became more interested in Christianity.
Oh, that's good. You got the saint stuff covered, so you're pretty good there. I don't know if you've noticed that trail of saints that you've left behind.
Right.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things I didn't mention in your biography is that you're not just your average run-of-the-mill philosopher, but you're also a math whiz, and you won a big prize for mathematical aptitude when you were at Pomona College, which I guess then jettisoned you to a degree in public policy, which has lots of statistical work over at Stanford University. So here's my question for you. How does a Californian numbers guy end up teaching philosophy in the frozen tundra of Minnesota?
Yes. Well, my undergrad degree, you're right, is in public policy with a concentration in quantitative methods of policy analysis. So that was a lot of statistics and econometrics. And I chose public policy because I wanted to go on to do some sort of work, some sort of career that would benefit people. And I thought, well, good public policy has a positive impact on a lot of people, so maybe I'll try that. But I had the opportunity to do a pair of internships during college in Washington, D.C., and the work just didn't grab me in the way I thought it would. At the same time in my life, I was becoming more interested in philosophical and theological questions, and I was becoming more serious about seeking a relationship with God. And so I ended up deciding that I wanted to make a contribution, or at least try, in an intellectual or spiritual way, rather than in a material or economic way, or policy way. And I was lucky to be able to attend St. Louis University, because one of the world's greatest Aquinas scholars is there. She does contemporary philosophy and Aquinas. Her name's Eleanor Stump. So she was a terrific mentor.
Very cool. And then how did you end up choosing Aquinas? I mean, so you're interested in religion more, but there's a lot of theologians you could be fascinated with. Why Aquinas?
Sure. Yeah, I have an answer to that. So my first experience with Aquinas was in undergraduate during the summer. It was a summer I wasn't working. I think it was after my freshman year. I had some spare time. I went to the local library, picked out book by Aquinas, just because I'd heard of him. Took it home, sat down in my comfy chair, opened it up, read a page, sort of a random page, and understood almost nothing. Closed the book, took it back the next day. Because Aquinas uses a technical vocabulary that, I mean, he's a very clear writer, but if you don't know the vocabulary, it's difficult to know what he's saying. So only much later, when I was getting a master's, did I have a professor who would explain what Aquinas was saying. And then I found that here is a person who had something insightful to say on an unbelievable variety of topics. Ethics, epistemology, metaphysics, God, human action. So Aquinas rewards the effort, and I could tell here's someone I can learn something from.
That is very cool. I'd love to talk to you more about Aquinas, because not only did he talk about all those things you mentioned, he was an economist in many respects,
true,
too.
Political science, economist. I mean, he died when he was 50, and the amount that he wrote and the quality, they say he could keep three scribes busy at once, working on three different documents. He would dictate to one, while that guy was writing down, he'd go on to the next one, go on to the next one, go back to the first guy, have him read back what he read. Yeah, he had a special mind, for sure. And so did Pascal.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Pascal here, but I got to say, if Aquinas had three scribes going and he died at 50, I'm over 50 now, and I think that's the trick. I need to get a couple more scribes for my stuff. I'm just doing it solo. That's my problem.
That's the only thing that separates you and Aquinas.
But we're not here to talk about Aquinas. We're here to put your mathematical acumen to work and sort out this thing called Pascal's Wager, and talking about your new book, Taking Pascal's Wager. A lot of math in here, so it's going to be kind of cool. I love this topic because in my economics of religion course, I use Pascal's wager to talk about the economic logic that is embedded in some theological thought as well. Students are always kind of surprised by that. Here's my question to you. You told us how you came about Aquinas, but how'd you come to write about Pascal?
Yeah, well, I first got interested in Pascal's wager in my undergrad as well. I took a game theory course, taught by a very eminent economic historian. And one day I went into, so game theory is about how to make strategic decisions in circumstances in which there's at least one other agent who is himself making strategic decisions. So there's a natural application to questions about how will I live my life, and how might that help me get close to God if there is a God. So I went to the professor's office one day, and I said, you know, I think making a commitment to God is a good strategy, because if God does exist, it's a good move, a huge good move. And if God doesn't, you really haven't lost all that much. And my professor thought about it. He said, yeah, I think you may be right, but why not wait until the very end of your life to make that religious commitment? And I didn't have anything to say at the time, but much later I was thinking about it, and I thought, well, that's a great strategy until you get hit by a bus. You don't know when you're going to die, so you're leaving a lot of chance if you just put this off. So I've long thought of Pascal's wager as a good argument, and it has a lot of relevance to the question of whether one should choose to live a religious life, whether it's rational. So in my teaching philosophy, I teach also a course called Faith and Doubt. I talk with students sometimes who are interested in Christianity, but aren't sure whether it's reasonable. And so I wanted to write a book for such a person. And the way Pascal's wager is relevant is that it lowers the bar on the amount of evidence you would need to rationally make a religious commitment. So here's the idea. Let's say you might think, I should only live a Christian life if I'm pretty much certain that Christianity is true, because, well, it's a major life commitment. But what Pascal argues, I think, successfully, is that's a mistake. Because so much is at stake, even if you only thought there was a 50% chance that Christianity was true, it could be rational to commit to living a Christian life, because there's so much to gain and comparatively little to lose.
Yeah, and that's what's really cool about this. I have to step back a minute, and when you talked about the should you wait until the end of your life in order to make the commitment? As an economist, we talk about this a little bit in the class too. And I said, well, you know, that's always dangerous because it depends on your discount rate, right? You think, I'm going to live till I'm about 90, but yeah, you might get hit by a bus. So it depends if you're living a dangerous life. And I always bring up one person in history who did wait till the end and play Pascal's wager, and that was Simon Bolivar, who was a fairly committed atheist for most of his life, or at least an agnostic. And then at the end of his life, he was on his deathbed. One of these people who saw the lights dimming, he says, bring in the priest. I got, let's take last rites just in case. So taking that bet at the very end. But very cool. So before we get into the actual wager, and you mentioned that it tends to lower the bar of evidence that you need for believing in Christianity, tell us a little bit about Blaise Pascal himself. I'm sure you did a little bit of research into who this guy was, and why did Pascal himself even think about writing about this wager?
Yeah, Pascal was amazing. He had many interests. So he's remembered as a scientist, primarily in physics, as a mathematician, as an inventor, and also as a theologian, a religious philosopher. He invented and helped bring about the construction of the world's first public transportation system. It was basically a bus drawn by a lot of horses in Paris. He invented a precursor of the computer, a mechanical calculating device. He did research that led to the invention of the hydraulic press, and I think he invented the syringe himself. So, many interests. But he was also a deeply religious man. He was raised in a Catholic family. Had sort of maybe a worldly period in his late 20s. And then in his early 30s, he apparently had an extremely powerful religious experience. So we only know about this because after his death, a servant found stitched into his coat pocket a description of this experience. Pascal called it the Memorial. It's also called the Night of Fire. And it's a description of this experience. It starts something like this. The God of Abraham, of Isaac, and Jacob, not the God of the philosophers. Certainty, joy, peace, something like that. So he tells you when it happened, and he says it lasted about 2 hours. Anyway, he had this deep religious experience. He wrote it up, stitched it into his coat, and he must have transferred the note from coat to coat for the rest of his life. He died when he was only 39, and he was in the midst of drafting a work of apologetics. So this was going to be a book that was an extended argument for the reasonableness of Christianity. But when he died, it was just a bunch of notes that people found after his death. Editors arranged them, and they were published as the Pensée. And I think they've been in continuous print ever since. So one of these notes has, and in Pascal's original, it has all these erasures and thing notes in the margin. It's just a mess. There's handwriting going every which way. And so it's this jumbled note that presents the argument that's come to be known as Pascal's wager. And I think people think that he wrote it for a skeptical person. It's an argument addressed to a skeptical person who's interested in Christianity, thinks it might be true, but isn't sure. And Pascal wants to argue they should commit to live a certain way.
Yeah, so he isn't dealing with, I guess, what we would call the new atheist today. I guess it would be the old new atheist in a time. Remind us what period he's writing in.
So this is the 17th century.
Okay, so 1600s.
I think he died in 1662, somewhere in the 1660s.
Okay, so you're...
I'm not sure. I don't know too much about the historical context, but I know that people say it was a skeptical age, and he certainly knew men of the world who weren't religious. And it's speculated that he wanted to craft an argument that would appeal to someone who, you know, wasn't already on board. So an agnostic.
Yeah, so I could see that because you're coming out of the Renaissance, moving toward the Enlightenment. You're kind of straddling those two major periods in history. So it makes sense that he would be writing something like this. What is his version of the wager?
He gives four different versions. I mean, this note is, remember, not a published, finished piece. So we don't know for sure what form it would have been in if Pascal had completed the work. But He gives four versions of an argument, and the strongest version can be summed up like this. It's rational to commit to living a Christian life because there's so much to gain and comparatively little to lose. So I can elaborate that on that. I mean, that's the basic idea. Sometimes the wager is presented as if your choices are either believe or don't believe. But Pascal himself considers the objection that, hey, wait a second, I can't just force myself to believe stuff. I believe things when there's really good evidence that they're true, and otherwise I just don't find myself forming a belief. So he has this putative, or this imagined objector in his note, say, very well, you've given me this wager, but I'm so constituted that I can't believe. And then Pascal responds, well, then live life a certain way. And so the idea is the action that is under your control is to seek a relationship with God or not. You can try to pray. Even if you don't believe in God, you can pray. You can say, God, if you're there, .. You can go to religious services. You can read the Bible or other religious texts. You can associate with religious believers, and most crucially, you can live the sort of life of moral excellence that you would think God would want you to live if God does exist. So that's the target action or strategy. Seek a relationship with God. And then Pascal's thought is that if you're willing to grant that there's a decent chance that God exists or that Christianity is true, then since there's so much to gain and comparatively little to lose, it's rational to wager for God. Now, the way Pascal actually presents the argument, one of the four versions I'm mentioning, he says, even if you're willing to admit that there's just a tiny non-zero probability, 0.001% chance that Christianity is true, even then you should commit. That's come to be known as the canonical version of Pascal's wager, and there's some good objections against it. I mean, it doesn't seem right to try to immerse yourself in living what you think is almost certainly false. But the stronger version of Pascal's wager, and one he also, another of the versions that he gives, is a version that's addressed to someone who thinks there's a 50-50 chance or better that Christianity is true. So if you think there's good evidence for the truth of Christianity, and I think there is, and you're in a situation where you think it's probably true, or at least 50% likely to be true, then the version of the wager that you get is very strong.
Yeah, I want to pause you here at this moment, because this is how I teach, and I didn't know about the four different versions. I haven't read Pascal. I guess I'm working off of the canonical version where you have a very small percentage. There's three aspects to this whole wager. There's the benefit side, which perhaps everlasting life in heaven, right? That's one thing. And we're also going to talk about some of the other more temporal or worldly benefits that come about. There's the probability side, which is the chance that you believe God exists or that God actually exists. And I'm going to ask you a little bit about that here in a minute as well. But then there's also the cost side. And what does it take to get those benefits? And you're going to weigh the probability times the cost and weigh it toward the benefits, or the probability of the benefits and weigh it against the cost. The way I've taught this in some of my classes was that if all you have to do is just believe in God, and I cite a few passages from Scripture. One of the ones that I do is John 6:47, and it says, I tell you the truth, he who believes has everlasting life. Well, that seems pretty easy. Just believe, and you get everlasting life. That doesn't seem too hard. The cost there is pretty good. Benefit, everlasting life, that seems really good. So even if the probability is really, really small, less than 1% or less than a tenth of a percent, it seems like a good wager to take. And there's a few other places I notice in the Scriptures as well, too, when in Luke chapter 23, when Jesus is up on the cross, he turns to these two criminals that are by his side, and he says to the guy, one of them says, hey, what sounds like a good deal? What do I have to do? And he says, just believe. And you're like, okay, sounds pretty good. It seems to me the canonical version, based upon Scripture, the probability of it could be really low, but the cost doesn't seem really high. How does Pascal examine the cost of Christianity?
Okay. I want to address that question about cost, but first I just want to note a worry. So you may say benefits are large. I mean, if you commit to God and Christianity is true, not only do you raise your chance of eternal life, but you also bring joy to God and you're more of a help to other people in their journey towards God. So the benefits are high. So why not just believe? Well, it may not be possible. I mean, if I say to you, Tony, I'll offer you $1 million to form the belief that the first person to cross the Alaskan land bridge, you know, 10,000 years ago, whatever that was, the first person to form that bridge was left-handed. Go ahead, believe that. And if you're like me, you'll think, I just can't do it. I mean, most people aren't left-handed. You know, maybe it's a 10% chance, but I can't actually believe it. So I could say it's true. I could say I believe it's true, but then I'd be lying. So there's something else that's relevant here. So it's just that many theists believe in God fundamentally not because of arguments, but because of an intuitive sense of God's presence. The belief can come naturally to many people. That's how it is in my case. And if you have that intuitive sense of God's presence, you can get rid of it at will by ignoring evidence or deceiving yourself or getting into activities that may cause it to disappear. So there is a role for will and belief. So your version of the wager might work when a person already has this intuitive disposition to believe, and what's in their control is kind of to ignore it or go with it. There you might have control over your belief. But for the paradigm agnostic, he's coming into the situation saying, I don't really know if God exists one way or the other. My evidence is this or that or balanced. For that person, it may just not be possible to form a belief at will in the way you can raise your arm at will. Now, you asked about the cost. So, suppose you commit to living a Christian life, and unbeknownst to you, atheism is true. There's no God at death, it all goes black. What have you lost? Hopefully we can talk later about what you may still have gained.
Mm-hmm.
But what have you lost? Well, you might have lost what Pascal called illicit pleasures. Maybe you've been living a demanding religious code that you wouldn't have paid so much attention to you if you hadn't been committed to that religion. Maybe you've lost some time in church, time praying. Maybe you've lost a sense of control over your life, the sense that you're your own master. Maybe certain relationships were more difficult for you. So let's say you're not living a particularly religious life and you start to. It's possible that certain people in your life may not approve. So you can have disruption to your social network. But with all those costs, there's various countervailing circumstances and goods to take into account. So, yes, you might have wasted time praying and spending time in church, but if you find the right church community, it can be fulfilling, even in this life. You can have great friendships and relationships in your church community. Prayer, maybe if God doesn't exist, you're praying to someone who's not there, and yet, brain researchers, Andrew Newberg is the name that comes to mind, have shown that prayer and meditation strengthens a certain neural circuit that improves your empathy and reduces certain negative emotions. So even if there's nothing afterwards, prayer can help you have a more, well, certain positive emotions and a feeling of greater content or peace. What else? Disruption to your social network. That's true. That may be a cost. But rather than just imagining all the things you'll lose, we should also think about things you might gain. So you might gain new relationships. There's research on how good people are at predicting their response, their emotional response to certain changes in their life. This is called affective forecasting. And it turns out people are pretty bad at it. I mean, they can tell if something's going to be good or bad, but they misjudge how long it's going to bother them. So that we typically overestimate how negative events will, how much they will bring us down. So anyway, there are some reasons to think the cost is not as high as the typical agnostic is likely to think.
And then also the benefits are pretty high. And that's one of the things that you do very well in this book is you bring to bear a lot of recent research that Pascal didn't have before him, talking, as you mentioned, the psychological and health benefits, mental health benefits of praying, as well as other health benefits. You cite Rodney Stark in here talking about the benefits of religious practice. And we've had him on the podcast before talking about that. And we'll link to that. Any other thoughts on Blaise Pascal's version of the wager, and then how has it been updated over time?
Okay. So here's a quote from Pascal. So he leaves it as sort of obvious that if Christianity is true, then committing to live a Christian life is the smart move. But then here's what he says about, well, what if you were wrong? What if you committed to live a religious life and it's false? He says, what harm will come to you from taking this course? You will be faithful, honest, humble, grateful, doing good, a sincere and true friend. It is, of course, true you will not take part in corrupt pleasure and glory and the pleasures of high living, but will you not have others, that is, other pleasures? I tell you that you will win thereby in this life. So Pascal, this fourth version of Pascal's argument is what a game theorist would call an argument from weak dominance. When you're deciding between two strategies or actions, and you don't know exactly which outcomes are going to follow because you don't know exactly how the world will be. When you're deciding between two strategies, but then you find that one of the strategy has this following feature, you know you've got a good strategy. So here's the feature. One strategy weakly dominates another. When it is never worse, it never leads to a worse outcome than the other strategy. And it sometimes leads to a better outcome. So let's say I flip the coin heads or tails, and you can choose one of two strategies, play or pass. So I flip a coin, and I don't tell you what it comes up as. You know it's either heads or tails. And I say, Tony, if you play and it's heads, you'll get $1, and if it's tails, you get nothing. If you pass, you get nothing either way.
Hmm.
Well, obviously, you should play. You're not guaranteed to win because it might be tails. But if it's heads, playing is a better strategy. You get $1 instead of zero. And if it's tails, you're no worse off. So Pascal's fourth version of the wager is an argument from weak dominance. It goes like this. If Christianity is true and you've committed to living a Christian life, you'll come out ahead. It will be better, you know, for you and other people. And then if Christianity isn't true, if atheism is true, you really won't have lost that much. Pascal, he says, you'll win anyway in this life. Now, I think we can weaken that argument a little bit. I try to do that in the book. So some people may balk at Pascal's suggestion that you'll win even if Christianity is false. They may say, no, these illicit pleasures, this sense of control, these are too important for me. I really will have lost something if I commit to living a Christian life and God doesn't exist. So I want to grant that premise. Maybe you've lost something, but say it won't be much. It won't be near as much as what you would have gained if you committed to Christianity, and Christianity is true. So the version of the wager I want to give goes like this. It's only addressed to a person who thinks there's a 50% chance or higher that Christianity is true. And the argument goes like this. Look, it would be irrational for you not to commit to Christianity, to living a Christian life, because doing so would involve foregoing a 50% or higher chance at the massive benefits which would come from committing to Christianity if it were true. And you'd be foregoing that chance for what? For a 50% or lower chance at the relatively small benefits that would accrue if you didn't commit to Christianity and Christianity were false. So you'd be trading a 50% or higher chance at a great good. You'd be foregoing that for the sake of a 50% or smaller chance at a small good, which is irrational.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a really neat update that you do in the book, and it's one that kind of surprised me. And that you put it, the probability at 50% and talking to that. But again, I think you could actually convince a lot of other folks, even with lower probabilities, based on that argument.
You know what? I think you're right. I tried to dodge that question in the book because I didn't think I needed it to get to the conclusion that I was shooting for, the conclusion that it's rational to commit to living a Christian life. But I think you're right. I mean, if you thought it were 30%, 40%, it would make a lot of sense to give this religion thing a try. Now, that may not be where you want to end up religiously, but it might be a better place than not trying at all, a better place to start. We might get to a problem, though, when we get down to 1%, 5%. What if you thought, oh, Christianity, that's almost certainly false. God exists, almost certainly false. Should you still live a Christian life out of these pragmatic considerations? Or is that sort of immoral? Does it involve a lack of integrity because you're committing your life to something you think is almost certainly false? And you're risking self-deception. You're risking becoming ensnared in an illusion. And I'm not sure. One day I go one way, another day I go another. So in the book I just said, well, look, because I think there really is strong evidence for Christianity, let's just consider the case where you think it's 50% or higher probability that Christianity is true. Then clearly you should commit. And then the second part of the book I tried to argue, and here's some evidence to try to show that the probability of Christianity's being true is 50% or higher.
Yeah, which makes this a very interesting book because it's not just a book about Pascal's wager, but you really look at the probability that Christianity is true in the second third of the book, and then finish off, which fascinatingly, with three lives of people who, under extremely difficult situations, still decided to believe. And you talk about how this benefits them, even under what most people would consider to be horrendous conditions. And so, again, recommend everybody take a look at this book. It's really well written. One of the things that we've been talking about in terms of Pascal's wager is Christianity. What is the probability of Christianity being true? Are there any other variants of this in other faith traditions, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, etc.?
Well, there certainly could be. I mean, almost exactly parallel reasoning could be used for a person who thinks that Islam is likely to be true or Judaism is likely to be true. So Pascal is often criticized for not taking into account that there are many possible religions. In fact, in other notes from the Poncet, he tries to give arguments for Christianity specifically and against other religions. But what's true is that the reasoning in the wager itself doesn't tell you which religion to choose. It just tells you should be committing to one of these religions rather than none of them. Well, then how do you choose which religion? I think the answer is pretty clear. You commit to the religion you think is most likely to be true, and as long as there's one that you think has some decent chance. So that strategy makes sense, because, I mean, if I thought Christianity is very likely to be true and Islam is possible but not very likely, of course it would be irrational to commit to living in a Muslim way rather than a Christian way, because that'd be it'd be like taking a medication that had a 1% probability of working instead of a medication that had a 80% probability of working. So yeah, Pascal's wager needs to be supplemented by evidence for this or that religion.
And that's one of the things that you do talk about in your book, in the section that deals with the objections to Pascal's wager, the question of, well, what if you choose the wrong one? What if you choose the medicine with 1% effectiveness rather than 80%? But there are some other objections as well. Some of these naturally come from the usual suspects you would consider your Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris's, but some of them also come from highly religious folks too. So review some of the objections to taking Pascal's wager, so to speak, and how you address those.
Okay. Well, let's talk about two. Let's talk about a selfishness objection, and then let's think about Calvinism and predestination. So the first objection oftentimes when I talk about Pascal's wager at a philosophy conference or in class, I'll get strong reactions. Some people will say, yeah, that makes sense. In fact, I sort of thought of that myself already. Some people will say, coming from an atheist or agnostic background, some people will say, this is totally irrelevant. We should do what we do based on evidence and truth alone. Pragmatic considerations don't matter. And then a third group of people are religious people who find the wager distasteful. And they say, rightly, I think, they say, you're missing something here. Real faith isn't about a cold calculation of expected value. I mean, real faith has to do with loving God for the right reasons, for who He is. And I think there's something right there. So let's look at the selfishness objection. The objection says, Pascal's wager won't work because God wouldn't be pleased even if He does exist. So if God does exist, He won't approve of your selfish wagering. Here are two replies. First of all, the version of the wager I defend doesn't require selfishness. So the version of the wager I defend mentions maximizing eternal life as a reason to commit to God, but it also focuses on the fact that the person who commits to God brings joy to God if Christianity is true. Like, think of the prodigal in the parables. The parable of the prodigal son. And furthermore, a person who takes the wager might be doing so because they think, you know, Christianity is true, and I live this devout Christian life, I'll help other people get closer to God. So the wager doesn't have to be motivated purely by self-interested reasons. But for the sake of argument, suppose it is. Suppose you commit to this religion thing just because of what's in it for you. Even then, we have to ask yourself, are you doing something wrong, and what would you have been doing otherwise? So, it's not wrong to want to be happy, and the means by which you take the wager are themselves actions that aren't wrong. They're things like praying or going to religious service. So it doesn't look like even if you're doing the wager just because you want to be happy forever, your ultimate goal isn't bad, and your means aren't bad. And then furthermore, here's the strongest reply to the selfishness objection. Yes, it's better to love God out of knowledge of who He is, and it's better to commit to God because of real faith than just because of Pascalian wagers. But Pascalian wagering might be a place to start. Indeed, the argument is addressed to a person who is on the fence and not sure whether to commit or not. And that person can go one of two ways: don't commit at all, or seek a relationship with God. Now, which path is more likely to have them end up with real faith? If they don't even commit at all, that's not going to help them end up with a real, authentic faith. So I think that taking the wager can be a first step. And then the person who takes the wager lives a certain way, and it may be that God will give that person faith. Basically, living the religious life can remove natural obstacles to faith.
Yeah, you had a part. You had a part in your book that brings us up. You were talking about J.J. Mackey's objection to the wager, saying, "Well, all you're doing is really just playing tricks on yourself." And I thought about this in my everyday context, that I intentionally take money out of my wallet so I don't stop at Dairy Queen on the way home. It's not because I want to live a healthful life. It's just that I know I'm going to go to Dairy Queen and eat and get all fat and everything. So I trick myself into avoiding this. But on the other hand, the outcome is that after a while I go, oh, living a healthy life is kind of good. And so I don't need to do it. So the tricks in what you were talking about, that, you know, arguing from a state of weak dominance, it does seem like a pretty good bet to take anyway.
Yeah. So we can address Mackey's worry in two ways. First, by noting on the version of the wager that I'm promoting, that the target isn't to try to get yourself to believe, it's rather to live a certain way. So you don't need to be trying to induce belief in yourself. That's the first thing. The second thing is, it is reasonable to think that you might gain evidence for God by seeking for Him. So even if you're just motivated by the truth, living a religious life might put you in a position to be close to God in a new way, which will allow you to gain new evidence through religious experience.
What about one of these other objections you mentioned a little bit earlier, Calvinism, and the whole issue of, well, does it really matter because we're all predestined?
Yeah. So the sort of thought, I don't think, I'm not saying any particular Calvinist would say this, but sometimes I get this question from audiences or students. The thought is, well, wait a second, if God calls all the shots, and if the doctrine of unconditional election is true, that is, if God simply, without regard to foreseen merit, just picks some people to be saved and some people to be damned, if that's true, then there's an assumption in the wager that's wrong, namely the assumption that committing to God will raise the probability of your being saved. But the objector is saying the probability is either one or zero, and nothing you can do will change it. The philosopher Jeff Jordan tells a joke about this. The joke is set in colonial times, and there's an old Calvinist who lives, you know, way out on his homestead, and when he takes his horse into town, he always brings a loaded rifle. And one of his Calvinist friends says, "Brother, why are you bringing a loaded rifle? Either the Indian's arrow will find its mark, or it will not. Trust in the Lord." And, you know, the idea is things are set forth by God. You don't need, you think you can make a difference by bringing this gun. And the old Calvinist, he kind of thinks about it for a while. He says, "Hey, I do trust the Lord. The gun is in case it is the Indian's time." So the thought of this joke is that it's very natural from a human perspective to want to take steps to alter our future, even if you also have the belief that you really can't do that because God has predestined everything. So what do we make of this objection? Well, the first thing to note is that the doctrine of unconditional election might be false. It was promoted by Augustine, apparently, although Augustine says different things at different times. But prior to Augustine, almost all of the church fathers rejected this sort of view, or rather promoted the view that there's cooperation between God's grace and human free will. So I talk about that in the book. Secondly, suppose that Calvinism, or rather the doctrine of unconditional election, is true. Even then, there'll be a way in which a Calvinist should be able to accept the wager. So the Calvinist is happy accepting propositions like this: you should not sin, you should have faith, you should believe in God. So the Calvinist has to have a way to accept those propositions, even though, literally speaking, they don't think it's in your power to do one or the other. But they still think it's true that you should. And so the conclusion of the wager, which says you should commit to living a Christian life, the Calvinist can interpret in exactly the same way that they interpret claims like you should have faith or you should believe. And the way that's probably going to go is in the premise in Pascal's wager, where it says by committing to God you'll raise the probability that you'll be saved. It's open to the Calvinist to take that purely in epistemic terms, not in causal terms. So here's the idea. The Calvinist, if you say to the Calvinist, now here are two people. One is believes in God, lives the commandments, ask God for forgiveness of sins, does all these things that Jesus asked, forgives his enemies. And then another person who does the opposite of all those things. Which person is more likely to be saved? The Calvinist is probably going to say, well, the first. And that's the sense of probability which they can use in the argument. That's a little technical, but I try to write that up in the book in a more clear way.
And you do. You actually present it in a very non-technical way, which is one of the benefits of this book, is that it deals with some game theory. Your mathematical background shows through in this book, but it's also very easy for the lay reader who's not familiar with game theory or other things like that to work their way through it. I want to move to the...
No, I tried to make it accessible because... In the last 30 years, there has been a tremendous amount of really excellent work in philosophy relating to the rationality of Christianity. But it's all in philosophy journals, and it's couched in extremely technical terms. It's hard for the outside to understand. So in the book, I'm trying to bring a lot of that down to earth.
And you do. You're very successful. So I am going to recommend folks pick up the book, Taking Pascal's Wager. One of the other things you do in the book, so we went through Pascal's Wager, some of the objections here. There's a few more that you cover, and I think readers would enjoy picking that up and seeing the other objections and how you deal with those. But the second part of the book I found very interesting is because you want to deal with the probability aspect. It's like, what is the probability that God really exists? And as we mentioned earlier, you set this probability at about 50%. So you're trying to take somebody who's flipping a coin here and trying to convince them, yeah, it's at least 50%, if not a little bit better. Go ahead and review some of the reasons that you think the probability that Christianity is true is true.
Sure. So first of all, I myself think the probability is very high, based both on the probability that Christianity is true is very high, based both on publicly available evidence and religious experiences I've had. But in the book, I'm trying I'm considering the position of the agnostic or skeptic. And so I'm saying, even if you think the probability is only 50%, you should still live a Christian life. And here's some evidence that it's at least 50. It's 50 or higher. First of all, let me just say briefly what I mean by probability here, and then I'll try to summarize the argument. And I'll summarize it briefly. You can ask me which parts you're interested in hearing more about. So what's meant by probability here? It's what philosophers call epistemic probability. So here's the idea. Different propositions or statements that you might consider, you will assign different levels of confidence to. So 1 plus 1 equals 2, you're very confident. You're probably certain it's true. I am. How about, I'll be alive tomorrow? I believe that. I'm fairly confident. How confident? Well, not as confident as I am in the belief that 1 plus 1 equals 2. But I still believe I'll be alive tomorrow. How about the proposition that I'll be alive in a year? Okay, I believe that. I still believe that. But at a lower level of confidence than the proposition that I'll be alive tomorrow, and so on. So what an epistemic probability is, it's the reasonable level of confidence to assign to a proposition or statement, given all your background evidence. If I have a fair six-sided die and I'm about to roll it, the reasonable level of confidence for you to assign to the proposition that it will come up six is 1 out of 6. That's the idea. So this is the sense of probability that we can apply to theories like the theory of continental drift, or even mathematical theories like Fermat's last theorem before it was proved. How likely was it to be true? Mathematicians thought, well, very likely, but they weren't certain. And so we can apply it to the proposition Christianity is true or God exists. So my argument in the second part of the book goes like this. There's a good argument that there's at least one necessary being that provides the causal explanation for all the contingent things that surround us, things like that tree or you or this table or the moon. Contingent things are things that exist but didn't have to. A necessary being would be a totally different sort of being which exists and absolutely has to exist in the way that 1 plus 1 has to equal 2. So there's a pretty strong argument that it's called the cosmological argument. There's a pretty strong argument for the conclusion that there's at least one necessary being which is the cause of the things we see around us. Next, the fine-tuning argument gives us evidence to think that there's an intelligence involved in the creation of the contingent world, a being with a mind. Then I argue that certain aspects of the content of Christian revelation make it likely to be true. The ethics that Jesus promotes has the ring of truth. Love one's enemies. It's very countercultural, but it seems right. And other things he says about loving God and loving one's neighbor being the core of ethics. Also, Christianity makes sense of a common human experience of the world, which is that there's something great and excessively noble about human beings, and yet we're capable of great evil. And there's sort of this dual grandeur but wretchedness to human beings, and Christianity has an explanation for that. We're created in the image of God, that's why we have this grandeur, but we have a fallen nature, and that's why we're capable of such evil. Christianity makes sense of that. Next, it's very natural just to feel, to have an intuition, that there's some sort of objective purpose or meaning to my life. And that's very hard to make sense of if we're just bags of atoms and humans have evolved without any prevision or guidance by God or any plan by God. So if we're just the random outcome of the interaction of atoms, it's possible, perhaps, but extremely difficult to make sense of the natural human idea that there's some objective purpose to my life. So that's evidence for Christianity. And then finally, I spend some time trying to address the problem of evil and the argument from divine hiddenness, which are arguments against God. And then I give summarize historical argument for Christianity from early Christian claims about the resurrection. So there I draw on Michael Lacona and Gary Habermas and N.T. Wright and William Lane Craig and Richard Swinburne and give what I think I think these scholars have given a pretty strong argument. If you start out thinking that God might very well exist, then the Christian explanation of the growth of the early church and the claims of the resurrection, the Christian explanation seems a lot more likely than the explanation that the early apostles were just lying for their own benefit or that they were hallucinating or something like that. So that's the structure of the second part of the book.
Yeah, and that's the one that you mentioned there at the end. We've had Michael Lacona on making some arguments about the historical validity of the resurrection using some archaeological evidence as well as some, you know, use of logic in that, which is really neat. And we'll point our listeners back to those podcasts. The one that caught my eye in your discussion, and you go from the cosmological arguments to begin with and all the way to the detailed historical arguments for the resurrection. The one that caught me was a little bit toward more to the cosmological end of things. And that's the argument about the multiverse, which somebody, if you talk to a physicist nowadays, they say, well, yeah, it's just coincidence that things have popped up and there's a million other universes out there that could be happening. And we just happen to be in this one. Talk a little bit about that one, because that is a unique argument that I haven't heard before.
Sure. So, let me develop this, and feel free to interrupt me if this goes too slowly. The fine-tuning argument starts like this. In the past 30 years or so, physicists and astronomers have discovered that many apparently contingent features of the universe are just right to allow for the development of life. This most striking case has to do with something called the cosmological constant. So this is a parameter in physics. It's a number that you have to go out and measure. And it governs or is related to the expansion, the rate of expansion of space after the Big Bang. Excuse me. So if the number is too large, space expands too rapidly, matter never coalesces and hence never forms stars, and therefore there are no elements other than hydrogen, helium, and maybe lithium. Hence, there's no chemistry to speak of, and as far as we know, just not the sort of stable complexity you need for life to be able to evolve. On the other hand, if the rate of expansion is too low, the force of gravity eventually causes the universe to decelerate in its expansion and then eventually contract, and so the Big Bang ends in a big crunch. And if it's just a little bit too low, this will happen, and you won't have time for evolution to occur. You might have a universe that lasts 10,000 years instead of we're at around 14 billion. So the cosmological constant has to be just right, but it's the degree of precision or fine-tuning that's so shocking to physicists. If we make the calculation in the most conservative way possible, it looks like out of 10 to the 41 possible values of the cosmological constant, only one would allow for the evolution and development of life. And we just happen to be in that sweet spot. So this is the fine-tuning argument. The idea is it's much more likely that we'd be in the sweet spot if the universe is the product of an intelligent being who values life, and much less likely if it's merely the chance product of some unguided physical process. So the fact that the universe is life-permitting is evidence for an intelligent designer of the universe. There are many objections to this argument. There's really only one, in my opinion, that's a strong objection, and it's the multiverse objection. So this is the objection that says, okay, designer, intelligent designer, God, that would explain why we're in a universe that permits life. But here's something else that would explain it. Maybe our universe is not the only universe. Maybe there's a vast number, possibly an infinite number, of separate bubble universes, separated by large distances or in different dimensions in some sense. And of all these many universes, most are not life-permitting because the cosmological constant and other features are wrong. But in a tiny fraction, the tiny fraction of the universes are life-permitting, and there's so many universes that there will be at least some life-permitting universes within the total ensemble. Now, where would we expect to find ourselves? Well, since since we're alive, we cannot observe a universe that's not life-permitting, so we can't expect to observe a dead universe. So our situation, observing a life-permitting universe, is just what we'd expect if we were in a multiverse. Somebody's got to be the lucky people in the life-permitting universe. It just happens to be us, and so we mistakenly think, there must be a creator. That's the multiverse objection. Now, shall I continue with some replies that I think are worth making?
Yeah, go ahead and explain it, because that is one of these arguments that I think is absolutely fascinating, saying, yeah, you know, the chance that we are alive is one in a billionth or some very small part. But then you answer, well, yeah, but there's a billion different universes. So obviously we're in the one in one billionth.
Yeah. So in a nutshell, here's why I think that objection goes wrong. If the multiverse theory were true, that is, if there were a multiverse with no God, so that you had a very small proportion of the universes being life-permitting. So if the atheistic multiverse theory is true, then while it is likely that there will be some life-permitting universes, it is extremely unlikely that this universe, the one we're in, would have been life-permitting. So what you would expect is that there would be some people around somewhere, but it would almost certainly not have been us. It would have probably been some aliens in a different universe. So here's the idea. Our total evidence isn't just that some one universe is life-permitting. Our total evidence is that this particular universe is life-permitting. And that's much more likely on the hypothesis that God exists. So let me try to go through that in a somewhat different way, a little more slowly. Here's the way I address the multiverse objection. We don't really know if we're in a multiverse. Nobody knows. But either we are or we're not. If we're not in a multiverse and there's only one universe, then the evidence that our universe is just right is strong evidence for the existence of an intelligent creator. On the other hand, if we're in a multiverse, the evidence we have is still evidence that we're in a multiverse created by an intelligent agent. because we've got to compare two theories. God might have created a multiverse. We've got to compare the atheistic multiverse hypothesis with a theistic multiverse hypothesis. I mean, we believe God created many planets, so maybe God created many universes. And here's the thing, in a multiverse created by God, you would expect the proportion of life-permitting universes to be not so low. Maybe high, or maybe just not so low, because God would value life. So for any universe he created, he'd have some reason to make a life from it. Whereas on the atheistic multiverse hypothesis, you'd expect the proportion of life-permitting universes to be extremely low, that 1 in 10 to the 41st number or something. So the upshot is that in an atheistic multi-universe, the probability that any one universe, the universe here, or the universe caused by that, the probability that any one particular universe will be life-permitting will be extremely low, like 1 over 10 to the 41st. But in a theistic multiverse, which has a much higher proportion of life-permitting universes, the probability that any given particular universe will be life-permitting will be much higher than 1 over 10 to the 41st. So the theistic multiverse hypothesis makes more likely the specific evidence we have, which is that this universe is life-permitting, the only one we know about, the only one we could know about. Basically, on the atheistic multi-universe, what we should expect, we should be surprised to be here at all. We should think, well, you and I could not have existed in a different universe, just like we couldn't have had different parents. So the only way we were going to show up on the scene is if a given particular universe, this one, would be life-permitting, and that was just extremely likely on the atheistic multiverse theory, whereas it's not so unlikely on the theistic multiverse theory. So this relates to some technical work in epistemic probability and evidence. There's a philosopher named Roger White at MIT whose work I draw on in the book. The argument is, this is a new argument, so it's bound to be controversial. I can't say I'm 100% it's true, but the more and more I think about it, the more and more it seems right that if we were in an atheistic multiverse theory, if we were in an atheistic multiverse, we probably wouldn't be here. And yet we are, so we have evidence against the atheistic multiverse theory, or any multiverse theory which says there's a small proportion of life-permitting universes.
Well, that all sounds very scientific. And again, for those of you who are interested in diving into it a little bit further and really spending some time with it, pick up Michael's book, Taking Pascal's Wager. We'll link to it on our website. But I want to mention one final thing in the final minutes we have here on the show is that you just don't deal with these probabilistic arguments, these sterile scientific cosmological constant arguments. In the last third of the book, you ground this in very personal terms, and you pick three Christians who lived very Christian lives under immense difficult circumstances. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which most people would know, Jean Vanier, and then Immaculée Illibigaza. I hope I'm pronouncing that name correctly. Why did you decide to include these three personal histories, or I guess you could call almost testimonies, of these three individuals in this book, which is could really be just seen as a probabilistic calculation book?
Yeah, well, here's why. Because when you make the philosophical abstract arguments, even if you agree with them, and you come to think, yeah, it probably is rational to commit to living a Christian life. Human beings are not well motivated by abstract arguments. I mean, it can happen, but it's not natural to us. And since we naturally desire knowledge and certainty, it can be very scary to make a major life decision based only on abstract reasoning. So it's helpful that there are real life examples we can turn to if we want to know, would my life be meaningful if I followed Jesus? Would it be a worthwhile life? We can get some help at answering that question by looking at others who've made a similar commitment, who've said yes to God. And if we see that indeed a Christian life can be beautiful, meaningful, moral, beneficial to society, good in all those ways, then it helps provide us with further reason to make a religious commitment. So if we were robots, the abstract arguments might be enough, but we're complete human beings with emotions and with a heart, and that's why looking at actual people's lives is helpful. So I wanted to pick contemporary individuals that readers could relate with, at least more easily than they might relate with Teresa of Avila or Augustine, who lived so long ago. So I wanted to pick contemporary Christians who lived a beautiful Christian life in very different circumstances. Jean Vanier is the founder of L'Arche. Hope I'm saying that right. That's an international organization that's devoted to people with mental disabilities. So in the L'Arche communities, mentally disabled people live together with mentally able people in houses or small homes. And it's an approach in which, rather than the mentally disabled being seen as just sort of projects to help, people that need to be helped, rather the idea is that a real community can be formed. And it's a beautiful thing. And then Immaculée Ilibagiza is a survivor of the Rwandan genocide. She hid for several months. She was hidden along with five or six other women in a tiny bathroom for several months during the height of the violence. She lost a tremendous amount of weight. I mean, she was skin and bones when she got out. The French finally came into Rwanda as the conflict was ending, and she made it to a French camp and then survived the genocide. But what's fascinating about her autobiography is she tells the story about how, inspired by her faith, she was able to forgive the people who'd murdered her family, and how this was a challenge and extremely difficult for her, but how it freed her in a way. I mean, it allowed her to move past, in some sense, move past the horrors that she lived through. So her story is one in which we see the tremendous power of faith in helping a person get through a tragedy, and the power of forgiveness that Christ calls us to. So those are a few things on Vanya and Olivia.
Yeah, and I have to compliment you for that technique in your book, because so many philosophical arguments can seem rather sterile. And as you're reading through the book, you make many sterile arguments. There's a number of Venn diagrams and things like that. But it really, that last chapter, really powerful to anchor this in somebody's really real life. And if more philosophers and social scientists would do that, I think we could reach a lot more individuals with our arguments. So kudos to you for doing that. My guest today has been Michael Rota. Michael, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.